I'm Tim Gombas, and this is Faith Improvised. It's a podcast where I can think out loud and talk with friends about things that interest me. Books, films, sports, music, culture, politics, the wonders and complexities of being Christian in this world, and my academic discipline, biblical studies. You're welcome to email me if you like at faithimprovised@gmail.com. This episode is a bit unusual. It's unusually brief. I recorded several segments, and I wasn't happy at all with how the main portion turned out, so I decided to chuck it. I'd rather have material out there in the world with which I'm satisfied than something I'm not so happy about. So in what follows, I have a few thoughts from the past week and a book recommendation, and that's it. Hope you enjoy it, and that you all have a fantastic week. So I'm recording this episode standing in my kitchen, looking out the window at an absolutely beautiful sunny day. It's a complete delight to see the sun. The sun is in the sky very differently these days, indicating that spring is on its way, and which is very welcome news. Winter is long here in West Michigan. And even though all of the sort of markers of seasons are just completely pulled up, and I don't know what time of year it is, I'm ready for winter to be done. And I'm ready to be warm. I'm ready to be outside. I'm ready to play golf, to enjoy baseball, to do spring and summer activities, which is great because today is baseball has begun. Spring training games start today. And that is really exciting. I'm always excited for a baseball season to start, and I don't need my team, I don't need the Chicago Cubs to really have a whole lot of hope and promise for any kind of a legitimate title run. I don't need that to be the case to enjoy baseball. I'm really looking forward to the season getting underway, getting out to games. We've got the Tigers single A affiliate here in Grand Rapids, the West Michigan Whitecaps. And I just love going to games. I go by myself and just sit and watch baseball and or go with friends. I don't know. I love getting out there. It's just a 10-minute drive away. I am not going to be going to spring training baseball this year, but I've got the MLB package, and I'm really looking forward to watching games. I got a voicemail from a person named Scott, and just to say, Scott, the recording was really awful, the quality, and your question got cut off, so I have no way to contact you. So please send me an email, and I'm very happy to send you my article on the household code. You had a question about that and had asked if I'd written anything on it. Indeed, I have. So send me an email and I'll send that out to you. Scott kind of cracked me up. He said he appreciates listening to this podcast because it pisses him off and makes him think, which kind of cracked me up. That's not an uncommon thing that I will hear. And I've heard that kind of thing over the course of my career. I teach, I have taught evangelical people for the last, over a decade and a half. And there's a lot of simmering sort of angst among evangelicals. And evangelicals tend to be a culture that want answers. They want the answers. They want to have the answers so that they'll be ready to get out there and have answers for people, for the general public, to be able to speak to issues or whatever. And I think that those are the kinds of people that I inevitably frustrate because I'm after good questions. I want to generate questions. I'm not necessarily interested in providing a body of answers for people to go out and tell people the answers. I think we need better questions. Also, just to say, I don't know exactly why Scott said, I don't know exactly what pisses Scott off about what the things that I say or anybody else. I do realize that there will be some evangelical people who listen to what I have to say and will become angry or frustrated or whatever, because I inevitably am very critical of evangelical culture. And just to say again, I love evangelical people. I have been loved by evangelical people. I've been nurtured and I have a good life based on so many people who are evangelical Christians. I don't want to criticize people necessarily, but I want to have a thoroughly critical posture toward the culture of evangelicalism. That is the habits, the cultural habits, the corporate patterns of thought and behavior, because this is the culture that I inhabit, and this is the culture in which I teach. And I think it's really, really important to expose to ourselves our own practices and our own habits so that we're very conscious of what they are. And if they can be reformed or improved or shaped or transformed, or if we can just eliminate a bunch of them that are destructive, that's good. As church cultures are always pursuing greater and more faithful embodiments of God's public justice, I think that that's necessary. So that's the posture from which I make any kind of critical comments. I don't like to have anything like a critical spirit towards people or individuals, even as I want to sort of be relentless in seeing the corporate dynamics that keep any of us from embodying God's justice as we might. So anyway, just to say, I don't want to be making anybody angry. I don't want to be pissing people like Scott off or anybody. That's not my aim. I don't want to get that kind of reaction. I do, however, want to be self-critical as an individual in my relationships with others. And I think it's important for cultures, you know, church cultures, corporate cultures, to always be self-critical, because how else can you grow? How else do people change? But to have that kind of self-critical posture. Anyway, just some thoughts about that. There's a lot of having a lot of email conversations about the topic from the last couple of weeks, but I'm going to move on in this space. I'm happy to write back. I'm way behind, so if you're waiting for an email from me, thank you for your patience. But I had a couple of thoughts about prayer over the last couple of days that relate to everything that I was talking about and the conversations I've been having about sovereignty, God's sovereignty, and suffering, and human experience, and all the rest. And I think that there is just a lot of scope for Christians to do a lot of careful thinking about prayer. And there's not enough careful thinking, not enough critical thinking about prayer. Paul talks about how Jesus and the Spirit are interceding for the church, but we're not told exactly how they're doing that. But one thing that Paul does say is in Romans 8, when he's talking about this, he says that we don't pray as we ought to. And I think that that is an invitation on Paul's part for us to do some real thinking about what we're doing when we pray, and to even be questioning our prayers and our praying, because so often our praying is just quite mindless. You know, how should we be praying? I don't take that. I think that that's an open question. That's not a given. And I think that there's a lot of scope for a lot more lamenting and a lot more confessing sin and less asking and certainly less mindless praying, less thoughtlessness, more simplicity, actually. I don't think that I mentioned this previously, but one of the most striking times of prayer that I can remember was probably about 14 or 15 years ago. My friend John was leading our gathering one evening, and about once a month, our church of which we were part in Ohio, Yeah, I try not to use that word too often. Ohio, where we formerly lived. Anyway, so some dark memories. But the church that we were part of, about once a month, we would just have prayer and not our normal order of whatever it is that we did. I'm trying to use different words because it wasn't really a service. What's being served? Why do we call it a worship service? And I think worship is not necessarily an appropriate title for what happens at that time. Anyway, our church gathering, we did something out of the norm once a month and just had prayer. And John said the way that we were going to do it is that someone was going to share how their week was or some difficulty that they're currently facing. And whoever was going to pray for them would pray a one-sentence prayer. That's the rule. You can only pray one sentence. And it was so striking that everybody had to actually think about what they were going to say, which was so salutary. It was just really interesting. And prayers were thoughtful and they were simple and they were meaningful because our typical pattern had been upset and everything became very, this is an overused word these days, but everything became very intentional, very purposeful. And yeah, that was a very interesting and memorable time together. So if you're looking for a way to pray more meaningfully, you can pray in that way or take up that invitation. Someone wrote me about a matter of interpretation and interpretation and application the other day. So I wrote a long email response back. But I should have said to her, and I just want to say to everybody, at Grand Rapids Theological Seminary, it's possible for you, no matter where you are in the world, to take classes with us. And every semester, I teach hermeneutics with my colleague, Jonathan Greer. He teaches Old Testament, I teach New Testament. And you know, you can join us live. You could take the class for credit wherever you are without leaving your location, and you could just join us live remote. I've had several people take out my invitations to take a class with me or to take our hermeneutics class, and I teach this with Jonathan three times a year in the spring, summer, and fall. So if you want to sort of engage with the kind of things that I talk about on this podcast week to week, that would be wonderful. Check us out. Check out our website. Send me an email if you want some more information. This is not a paid advertisement. I'm just telling you, it'd be great to have you in class. Check us out. I want to tell you about a book. The author is Jason Stanley, and the title of the book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And it's published by Random House. I heard Jason Stanley on a podcast a couple weeks ago, so I thought, I got to pick this book up. Sounded really, really fascinating, and it was. And I'm interested in this topic because basically we've just come through a season with a president that wanted to rule in a fascistic manner, you know, in an autocratic manner. So I'm interested in understanding these dynamics. What is really, really interesting is that there's a sense in which fascism or fascistic impulses are always up and running wherever there is liberal democracy. Plato knew this, you know, a couple thousand years ago, where he talked about how tyranny usually follows democracy. So this is an element, I think, that is always up and running. And I'm not just sort of like a blind fan of liberal democracy. I think that this era, the era, you know, of the West or the modern era or liberal democracy needs to be understood with a from a critical perspective. But I mean, goodness, I don't think that I want to live in a fascistic state either. So I want to understand what the dynamics are of fascism. And Stanley goes through them. He talks about the mythic past and think about the previous president and his motto of promising to make America great again. Well, fascistic movements around the world have needed to sort of invent a shared history in order to justify injustices of the current moment. And that was also an attempt to do that. Involved in fascism also is propaganda. The big lie, basically, that the election was stolen. And Stanley goes through a bunch of lies that propagandists need to sow within culture. And he talks quite a bit about how propaganda works. Fascism also is anti-intellectual. And we certainly saw this with the previous president. And I think that this is really important to talk about because the culture in which I was raised and the culture that I inherited, white evangelicalism in America, has a strong anti-intellectual impulse running through it, which is one of the reasons why so many white evangelicals resonated with and appreciated the previous president. There's a commitment to unreality in fascism. And my goodness, we saw that constantly. I just think about the Washington Post counting the number of lies or false statements that the president made, and was over 30,000 or so. In so many ways, that sort of missed the point. The previous president was sort of a portrayer of an alternative reality. And he certainly lived in it and needed everybody else to live in it. And there sort of has to be a party-wide and even nationwide commitment to unreality. And sadly, in the current Republican Party, we're basically seeing that, which is just, it's mind-blowing. Fascism also involves hierarchies and certain ethnicities over others. We certainly see this in American culture, and this has been true for hundreds of years, that American culture has centered whiteness and has elevated white people over black and brown people, so that when progress is shared or when dignity is spread around, and there's the sort of the feeling on the part of white people, especially white men, of losing their place in the hierarchy, that spawns feelings of victimhood. And Stanley's got a chapter on that, victimhood, and how that works and how it is manipulated by a fascistic political actor to sort of engender the resentment necessary for that person to rise in power. Again, this resonates powerfully with white evangelical culture. There's a sense of victimhood that's quite strong, and there's a perversion of sort of a suffering or persecution narrative that is, you know, the way it is at work often is out of all proportion to what is actually being spoken about in the New Testament. Well, Stanley has chapters on law and order and what that actually means. A really interesting chapter on sexual anxiety and how national cultures or a fascistic political actor will draw upon sexual anxiety to portray others, outsiders, immigrants, as rapists, which the previous president certainly did. And that's been an ongoing trope throughout instances of fascism around the world and over the last couple hundred years. And by the way, that's the same sexual anxiety that drives the feeling that what we really have to talk about is certain genders using certain bathrooms. Anyway, just so much confusion around all of that, but a very interesting discussion that Stanley has on that topic. He has a lot to say about the resentment of elites on the part of fascistic political actors. I mean, fascist political actors need to sow resentment of all kinds of others, but certainly intellectuals and certainly cultural elites, which is a complete myth and an invention for the most part. Anyway, if you want to understand fascism, I highly recommend Jason Stanley's book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. I think it's really important to understand the dynamics of fascism, because even though we sort of escaped narrowly this flirtation with autocracy or fascism, that impulse runs through our culture very strongly. And my goodness, I just want to see it coming. So check out Jason Stanley's book. Highly recommend it. And I also highly recommend that you get it from an independent bookstore.